At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is continuing coverage.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Now back to the courtroom.
Now I want to start off by telling Your Honor, CPT does not conduct investigations, period. They are not investigators. For Kimberly Griffin to be described as an investigator is not correct. She may have been a manager. She is not an investigator. CPT does not conduct investigations. That's number one. Number two, the court may recall I mentioned earlier that the state's theory initially, as long as Judge Moreland's pronouncement was admissible, was that created the motivation for Miss Benefield to kill her husband, because she knew that Dr. Broder's report was to be released 3 days later. Now, the courts prohibited the state from using Judge Moreland's pronouncement. So they have pivoted, and now what they're going to do is they're going to say that failure to receive satisfaction from any of these child abuse allegations created the motivation for Miss Benefield to shoot Douglas Benefield. Now here's the problem that they have with this. And here's instinctively where I believe the court is having problems reconciling it. First of all, the court ruled as to Deputy Moreland that he would be limited, no different than the court ruled as to the domestic violence injunction that Judge Moreland denied. Deputy Moreland would be able to say they received the complaint, no action was taken, the end. No comments one way or the other. Well, the problem with this is, by implication, if not by actual design, they want to disclose to the jurors that the person making the report, the allegation, is Ashley Benefield. If nothing else, the court has got to realize from the law that we've provided, Your Honor, they cannot disclose.
Before you go much further, I'm pretty sure they put in writing that they're not going to argue that or present that testimony or evidence.
Correct.
Okay. I think they put that in writing.
Okay. Then what could the relevance of this possibly be? What is Kimberly Griffin, who is disclosed at the last minute, going to add that Deputy Moreland is not going to present? I think the implication is, because she's from CPT, it raises the issue of child abuse and whether or not allegations made were vindicated. We got enough to do in this case dealing with the charge of second-degree murder. The trial's not supposed to be about whether or not the allegations of abuse were founded or unfounded, true or false. And I think under 403, it very well may create in the minds of the jurors, well, let's see, okay, the deputy came in and said there had been some matters investigated, but nothing came of it. Why is child protection here? What is that all about? Was there something going on that we don't know about? I think it's an opportunity for contamination of the trial with nothing really to be gained. She's not going to add anything of significance, hence the court's evaluation under 403. What's the probative value? There is no relevance to it. It adds absolutely nothing to what Deputy Moreland is going to say. Additionally, I mean, look, Judge, I attached it even to my response on the last page. It couldn't be any clearer. This is from the report from CPT. Confidential dissemination of this material is restricted under Florida Statute Section 39.2026. This is precluded from being presented to a jury.
Well, we need to kind of step past that. I mean, you've been doing criminal defense long enough. I assume, were you with the state in the past?
Have I what?
Have you been with the state in the past? Have you done both sides? Were you a prosecutor at any point?
Yes, okay. State and federal.
All right. CPT videos are introduced into evidence in child sex cases. The interviews with the minor victims are put into evidence all the time, and the records can come in. So there are exceptions for records to be admitted into other criminal proceedings.
I was just going to say to the court, you're absolutely right, and that exception was added to the statute several years ago. There is no exception for this. If the court looks at the statute, there is no exception to call some CPT case manager to disclose things that are not entitled to be disseminated. And even if there was, what is the probative value? What is it going to add that Deputy Moreland is not going to provide? Further, it raises the issue and puts me in the position that, and the court knows how testimony is, if something comes out, we have two complaints that were filed in this case by independent third parties, both professionals, one a pediatrician and the other a psychologist. Independently, they called in child abuse complaints to DCF or CPT. If I get a statement by this witness that's adverse to Ms. Benefield, I have to go there. That's going to open up a can of worms once again that's going to jeopardize the jury's consideration of what's at play here. And why are we doing it? What is the probative value that puts us in the position to risk that? There is none. And even if the court gets past what a late disclosure this was, even though they've now withdrawn her as an expert, it's still inappropriate. It was late. I'm 5 days out from trial. I don't have the time to chase a deposition now. And it adds nothing. And I think the court should deny it.
Let me ask you this. As you've noticed with several of my rulings over the last couple of months, I hesitate to make a pretrial ruling that tells either party, you may not call this witness. I think I've demonstrated that.
Yes.
With the understanding that I've already made the ruling, detective or deputy, whatever his name is, Moreland. I can't say Moreland because then we're going to confuse the other one. I'm just going to say Detective Moreland. That's how I remember it. With the knowledge that I've allowed already, that Detective Moreland can testify to these four complaints, criminal matters that came to his division, when the essential allegations, they were investigated, closed with no charges being filed. Is again, I don't want to limit myself, but I seem to think that that's the ruling. If the state was allowed to elicit from Detective Moreland that those same complaints were also sent to the Child Protective Team, they conducted their separate investigation and nothing was, I don't know, was anything filed? See, that's where I'm going to run into a problem, because there was a dependency case. I don't know which ones, I don't know which of these four, or was it some other investigation that led to the filing of the dependency case?
Well, let me remind the court of something. We objected to Deputy Moreland's testimony, and the basis for Your Honor's conclusion that it was admissible, at least the dichotomy that the court seemed to draw on, was that as a deputy, as part of a criminal inquiry, the court was going to allow it. Okay, we disagree, but we'll live with it. Now, though, we're over on the other side, completely away from that justification, and we're into the workings of CPT and what the implications of it are. And I'm only telling the court, particularly because there were two independent professionals who called in complaints.
Of the four that we're talking about?
I don't know if that was included in the four or not, but I'm telling the court that the pediatricians called in, as did one of the psychologists. I'm going to have to go there. And as soon as I go there, it's going to leave them wondering. And I'm just saying to the court, what is the prize that is allowing the court to consider taking that step and letting us go down that road? What is to be gained by Kimberly Griffin coming in and essentially, from the court's own questioning of Ms. O'Donnell, saying what the deputy had to say? What's the point? And I think it just opens us up to a problem with nothing to be gained. And I think that's overlooking and getting past the untimely discovery. So,
which is still, that's still on the table.
Yeah.
I didn't want to cut you off.
Right. And not to mention the confidentiality of this information. I mean, I put it in our response. It's pretty clear, Judge.
Mr. Donald, I do have to come back to you, though, because as I was thinking about, you know, the excluding a witness, I think we can all agree the case law is very clear. The exclusion of a witness is one of the most extreme sanctions or decisions that a trial court can make when it comes to the time leading up to a trial. And the appellate courts have very clearly spelled out that that should be the very last option after looking at and considering and trying every other reasonable option that's available. So that's where I started thinking, and I'm just going to lay it out here so we have this discussion so we can try and get this done. Well, what if I allowed the state to bring in through Detective Moreland that along with his criminal investigation, that initial report goes two different places. There's criminal investigation, there's CPS or CPT investigation, and he investigated his end, it was closed, and you know, Detective, just tell us briefly what the CPT is. I'm sure you could give a very generic overview of what they are and how, even though they're both in the sheriff's office, they are siloed in different departments. You just have him say, my cases were closed with no charges, but then I started thinking, well, some of these may have been the complaints that resulted in the dependency cases, and so it wouldn't fit. So how did you plan on addressing that with, first, Were any of the cases, the four, I assume, cases Ms. Griffin was going to talk about, did any of those lead to the dependency case?
I'm not aware of that. And I apologize, Judge, because I've never done family court, so I'm not aware. I don't know what the difference is between dependency and domestic relations. They had a dissolution of marriage and issue of time sharing with the child pending for most of this, so I don't know if that qualifies as a dependency case.
That's a DR case. That's a domestic relations.
Okay, so that's what was pending. It wasn't dependency until, it's my understanding, until after the homicide happened, then it became a dependency case.
Oh.
So I think it was just, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it was all DR, domestic related with marriage and time sharing and that type of thing, and criminal.
Okay. I don't know the words to express how illuminating you just said and how it makes me go back and think about a lot of things. I have been operating under the premise that there was a dependency case, and I've asked this multiple times. Who is Broder? How was he involved? Who appointed him? Where did he come from? What I understood from the Stand Your Ground was that he came from the CPS world, and it was part of a dependency case, which is, and the simple difference is this. Dependency is the state of Florida saying, for whatever reason, your child is now in need of services. You are unable to care for your child, whether it's lack of protection or affirmative abuse, whatever it may be, and we are going to temporarily remove that child from you, and there's going to be a parenting plan, and you need to do X, Y, and Z over this time frame. And if you don't successfully complete X, Y, and Z, we may then terminate your parental rights. It's the state of Florida's action against the parent. Domestic relations is mother or father, if it's a paternity, or husband and wife, or husband and wife, whatever the relationship is dissolving that legally created union between the two. Or, of course, in the case of paternity, there was no prior lawful union between them, but there's a child, and now we have to establish, is this man the biological and legal father of the child? And then we start talking about the time sharing and the child support and everything else. That's a very simple explanation. So the investigations that Miss... So I still don't know how Broder got involved. Was he CPS?
He is a contractor for CPT.
Mm-hmm.
And what they ended up doing was what's called a multidisciplinary meeting. So CPT, CPS, law enforcement, everyone got together and talked about things and recommended that they have the psychological evaluation by Dr. Broder.
All right. That sounds to me like a precursor to a dependency case. Again, I have not practiced... When I was in private practice, I didn't do dependencies, and I have not sat on the dependency bench yet. So I'm not as intimately familiar as I may seem. But I guess what I'm saying is Broder was involved before the homicide.
Yes.
And so Broder must have been involved through CPS or CPT.
CPT.
As a result of one of these four calls?
It was a result of the multidisciplinary meeting after the four calls. Because
all right.
The calls kept coming in, and they were concerned that this kept happening, and we want to see if we can get to the bottom of why this keeps happening, and so then they called in Dr. Bird.
All right. And then... And so what I've allowed for Detective Moreland, he finishes with, and no charges were filed.
Correct.
It was closed. Whatever language I allowed. If you put Griffin on the stand, she's not going to conclude the same way.
Right. She will. I don't know what the terminology is that they, you know, they don't recommend that anything be done other than counseling and evaluations or whatever. You know what I mean? They don't make a recommendation like charges be filed. It's their terminology.
How does that fit in with your theory?
Well, first...
Hold on, I'm coming back. How does that fit in with your theory?
Well, because if it's not going to go the criminal route, they could still go the family route to take away this child or take away, you know, get the father away from the child or get the mother away from the child. Or they have different avenues that they can use in a situation other than criminal charges.
Okay. Anything else? Because I am going to go back. Because I want to give you the opportunity because I raised some new issues.
Yeah, if you give me just
thank you.
One more.
Of course, yeah. So like I said, I raised some additional issues, so I'm going to give you the opportunity to rebut those or address them.
In response to what Ms. O'Donnell just had to say, this is a criminal case with a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. What CPT does, and whether or not they could pursue something else, it doesn't comport with that standard. They have no obligation to meet that standard. It's basically a civil agency. It is not part of the Sheriff's Department, CPT. They're part of the Department of Health. And as far as Broder goes, so that the court perhaps now begins to see what I've been trying to point out all along, Broder was hired by CPT. And that's the reason why Broder's report comes under the auspices of CPT and the confidentiality of CPT. And Broder himself, in his deposition, said his client was CPT. That's who hired him. So he should have never been allowed to testify, and his testifying was a breach of that duty and that statute. I want to also tell the court that it's, and I want to draw a real clear distinction for Your Honor. Yes, exclusion of a witness, I believe in the words of the case law, the court quoted it correctly, is a drastic remedy, the last remedy to be considered. That applies, and that standard applies to exclusion of a witness based upon a discovery violation. Here, we have a whole different consideration by the court. The court is not excluding a witness because of a discovery violation. The court is evaluating the relevance of that witness's testimony and concluding that that testimony is not relevant. It does not have any probative value under 403, and further under 403, it may create confusion of the issues and raise something that presents a problem to a fair trial. So the court is excluding the testimony based on that basis. The court is not excluding the witness because of a discovery violation. It's a different standard, Judge White. Does the court have any questions?
No, I'm ready. All right, thank you both very much. So, multiple issues, and I know the defense has just said that this is not a discovery violation. However, the magic words of Richardson don't have to be uttered. I am going to conduct a full Richardson evaluation because the failure to conduct a Richardson hearing, even when the magic words are not used, is fundamental error. And so I am going to conduct a Richardson evaluation.
I'm assuming that by virtue of the argument that we've had, the court is going to get past the discovery aspect of this.
So to start with that, under Richardson, when it's alleged or intimated that there has been a late discovery, a late listing or a discovery violation, the court is required to conduct a Richardson hearing. The determinations there are whether the a discovery violation was willful or inadvertent, trivial or substantial, and what the prejudice is to the party that is the recipient of the discovery violation. In this particular case, I will find, based upon the competent substantial evidence that is before me, that it was an inadvertent failure to list Kimberly Griffin as a witness. It has been represented to me by the state that her reports by her were provided and were listed early on, and that it was inadvertent that her name was not placed on the witness list. Certainly, had she been there, it could have been an A, B, or C, and the defense could have either taken her deposition or not taken her deposition, but I do find it's inadvertent. Is it trivial or substantial? I do not find that Ms. Griffin's testimony or evidence is substantial in this matter. I think she is trivial in that she has information about unrelated matters that the state wants to discuss and intends to introduce into the trial to support its theory of prosecution. But I don't find that she's a substantial witness or an essential or material witness to the state's case. The prejudice to the trial preparation, I have not heard a significant amount about how the defendant would have altered or changed her trial preparation by the disclosure or the lack of disclosure for Ms. Griffin. To be frank, I don't think it sounds to me like there would have been much change or alterations to the defendant's trial prep for the essential information I'm allowing through Detective Moreland. When I make my 403 analysis in a few minutes, I'm going to talk about this prejudice again, but for purposes of Richardson, I've not heard that the defense would have substantially altered or changed its trial prep. So I, having conducted the Richardson hearing, I find that there is not a Richardson violation. Getting to the substance of the testimony, on the issue of whether it's relevant or not, I think it's relevant from the state's perspective to support their theory of defense that I don't need to rehash, was laid out throughout the Stand Your Ground hearing and the other hearings we've been to. So I'll find it's relevant for the state's purposes. The admissibility issue, I think that I could address, if I were to allow it, I could address the admissibility by stripping down, Ms. Griffin's testimony to just the essential allegations as I allowed Detective Moreland. And I could certainly require either a limiting instruction or require testimony to be clear that Ms. Griffin and Detective Moreland are referencing the same complaints. And they may have to check that because I don't know yet. I haven't received competent substantial evidence that they were the same four complaints. But I'm going to operate on the presumption that they were. The reason Detective Moreland's testimony works is it's relevant to the state's position, and I'm able to avoid problems with 403 by limiting what he's allowed to testify to. My concern with Ms. Griffin, as I expressed earlier, is the fact that it appears that one or more of those phone calls that Detective Moreland is going to say didn't result in criminal charges, on the CPT side of it, resulted in some sort of action, whether we're going to call it a dependency case, they opened that but it just wasn't filed, whether it was called a staffing, whatever it was called, I haven't received testimony or evidence what they call it, but some sort of action by the Child Protective Team to address those allegations, because we've got meetings with CPT, we've got these interviews that I've heard about, we've got Dr. Broder being brought in. From the testimony I remember at the Stand Your Ground hearing, he seemed to have been involved for several months, meeting with everybody multiple times, hours and hours of observation time and interview time with the parties. And my concern is, Ms. Griffin's testimony is going to be, yes, as CPT, we did these investigations, and we felt there was enough for us to get Dr. Broder involved and at least take some sort of agency action. And to the extent that I said earlier, I think that could confuse the issues, and at that point, the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of confusion of the issues to the jury, and misleading of the jury as to how many complaints were actually made. But I don't disagree with the defense, is that if then Ms. Griffin is allowed to testify that based upon these complaints, yes, we did take some action and Dr. Broder was brought in and we did these, whatever it's called in their nomenclature, I'm just going to call it a staffing. I think basically what I'm asking for there and what I'm going to allow or have to allow for the defendant to fully address those issues is we're going to have a mini dependency trial within this murder trial. And if my rulings before haven't been clear, at least implicitly clear, this is a homicide trial, a murder trial. I'm trying to avoid having a family law, domestic relations, divorce, child custody, child time-sharing trial within this murder trial. I'm trying to avoid having a criminal trial of other criminal charges that may or may not be appropriate in this murder trial. I'm trying to avoid having a dependency case in this trial, within a trial, just to keep it, to keep everybody focused on the issues. And I've tried to give latitude to both sides to follow their theories and present their defenses and their arguments on the state side. But the nets that both sides are casting are just getting a little bit too wide. So based upon that...
Judge, can I just clarify something real quickly? I wasn't sure. I know that you said that the CPT did recommend a staffing. The staffing was basically to evaluate why the defendant kept making allegations. It wasn't against...
I don't know that.
Okay. Well, the way you said it made it sound like it was against maybe Doug Benefield.
I don't know
that makes a difference.
That's what I'm trying to say is I have zero idea.
Okay.
What was it for? Did they put some credence in some of these complaints? Did they finally realize that this is a repeated false allegations we need to get? I don't know. I have zero idea.
That was why.
All right. So at this point, and this is just a motion in limine, but based upon what I've heard so far, no, I would not allow Ms. Griffin to testify on the 403 grounds. I think it's just going to, the probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of confusion of the issues, misleading of the jury. I don't even know what I'm granting. I'm going to grant the defense's motion in limine to prevent Ms. Griffin from testifying. That obviates the need, obviously, for a Daubert, because the state had already said they weren't an expert. She wasn't an expert. Now, that's a motion in limine. We may get to trial, and there may be a proffer for the actual trial itself, and I'll address it then. State, I think certainly you might have certain appellate rights before trials that you can avail yourselves of. That's why I'm making a fairly clear ruling that, based on what I've heard so far, I am not allowing her on 403 grounds. Okay, that was the second part of that.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where'd my list go? So I've got jury questionnaires, I've got paralegal sitting at defense table, and I've got my colloquy. Which one do you want to handle first?
Up to you, Your Honor.
All right, let's go with questionnaires. So you propounded, state you're objecting?
Yes.
The state objected to it in its entirety.
All right, let me lay this out too, because I don't know if you want to incorporate this in. There was discussion. Actually, back in May when I started talking about jury selection issues, I don't recall talking about specifically about a customized jury questionnaire. The first thing I remember that's conscious in my mind is maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, my judicial assistant came in and said the defense wanted to know if I was fundamentally opposed to jury questionnaires. Okay. First, there was an email. She came in and said something along the lines of, how do you feel about jury questionnaires? And my response was, well, the parties need to talk amongst themselves if they want to do that. And I think she said that from Mr. Taylor's office, the question was actually rephrased of, are you opposed to them? And the answer was no, I'm not opposed to them. They can be very valuable in certain cases. And that's where I left it. I wasn't asked, am I going to do them? Will I allow them? It was just, am I fundamentally opposed to them? And the answer was no. And then Mr. Taylor had sent some. I don't have them printed out, but I have them by email. And it was my understanding that the state was objecting.
That's correct.
All right, go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Your Honor. The state is objecting on multiple grounds. The first being this jury questionnaire, I should say, Judge, there was some conversation between Ms. O'Donnell and Mr. Taylor about whether or not we would agree, and the state's position was if the juror questionnaire was focused and as to media, or if the, you know, if the jury had heard about the case. We then received, I believe July 3rd, this 28-page juror questionnaire. I think it has 90 questions with some additional exhibits or additional responses on it. The state would object, 83 questions, sorry, that this would be asking the jury some very pointed questions where, in a vacuum, where they have not been explained by Your Honor or during the morning session what their obligations are as a juror, the rules regarding what they're allowed to consider, what they're not allowed to consider, those kinds of things. And the state feels that that would be inappropriate based on the type of questions. Additionally, the types of questions here, some of them are already handled by our short questionnaire. Some of them are extremely intrusive. Have you ever had a divorce case? When was it? Do you hear the Me Too movement? Do you agree with statements about Me Too? Do you political questions? Has anybody in your family ever been divorced or been in a family law case? Those kind of things that seem inappropriate. And procedurally, I don't know how this would be accomplished, because the juror, even if it had gone out on the 3rd, you'd be asking jurors at home to fill out a 28-page questionnaire, and then somehow have the state and the defense digest that material for jury selection on Monday, it would take a day or days to go through 70, I don't know how many jurors Your Honor requested, 70 jurors, 30 questions, you know, 30 pages of information each. However, I don't know the number, but.
Well, no, the panel is going to be 70.
Okay. So
I asked them to summon 500.
Okay. Right. So I can't even imagine having to deal with that with this questionnaire. I did find a case it's called State v. Thayer. I brought copies. Ms. O'Donnell found a case, I should say. And it's, would you mind?
It's 528 Southern 2nd, 67. It's from 1988, and it is the 4th DCA. And it just discusses, this was a 36-question questionnaire. And it said, numerous subparts submitted to the prospective jurors that probe the jurors' politics, religion, social views, hobbies, books read, what, if any, bumper stickers they had, which many of those questions are on this questionnaire, and they found it was improper and went far beyond the questions that might ordinarily be asked. But I thought the most telling part is that the court said, many of such questions could be unnecessarily embarrassing to a citizen who, according to the record here, is admonished in the proposed questionnaire that you are required by law to promptly answer, and if that, and if he does not, he will be guilty of contempt. This questionnaire does not say that, but this questionnaire requires them to sign and says that you are expected to sign and your answers will have the same effect as a statement given in court under oath. So I think it's a very similar type of admonishment to the jurors. We're asking you to fill out this obtrusive, lengthy questionnaire, and if you and it and consider it sworn under oath. And I just think it's improper in the state of Jackson.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yes.
Mr. Taylor.
I am happy to say that this is one of the few occasions when all of us have the same objective. We all, both the state and the defense, as well as the court, want a panel of fair and impartial jurors. So that's the first thing we can agree upon. The second thing we can agree upon is that this is one of those many matters that comes within the sound discretion of the trial court. So, my inquiry about whether the court was fundamentally opposed was before I commissioned such a questionnaire. If the answer was no, well, that was the end of it. That was not the answer that I received. I'm repeating this not to attribute any responsibility. I then immediately provided the state with the proposed questionnaire. Now, as the court might guess, in formulating the questionnaire, I erred on the side of liberality, including every question ideally that I would like to know. Of course, governed by proper restraints and reasonableness. The state's response, rather than parsing the questions, was, hell no, we object to the whole thing.
Judge,
get lost.
The state didn't speak like that.
Well, that was my editorial, sorry. Now, what I would have intended was that they would have gone through the questionnaire and they would have sent it back with 15, 20, 30 questions stricken. I would have looked at them, no different than the 9/11 transcript. I would have either thrown them out and said, okay, here's what's left. Can we submit it to Judge White? Instead, they just took the position, we object in toto. Fine.
Bless you.
I then sent the court the questionnaire, fully expecting that Your Honor would edit the questionnaire according to what the court felt was appropriate. I stand before the court today now with that same position. I am happy, given the fact that we all agree on the objective, to send out whatever the court reasonably believes is a fair inquiry to help us in the jury selection. I know if we can have a jury in one day rather than in three, that's going to benefit all of us. I don't know what the jurors' predispositions are. We don't find that out until we put them in the box and we question each one. So it's not only a time-saving opportunity, but again, I'm more than happy to have the court purge whatever questions the court thinks are inappropriate. What we would be left with would be some kind of guide as to what we're dealing with so that each side could then say, Judge White, before we get started, I think juror number 16, 25, 35, and 27 should be excused for cause. You look at the questionnaires, you agree, they're gone. That's it. We save the time and energy of questioning all of them. That is still my position. So if the court wants to redact the questionnaire, which I fully expected, I'm fine with that. But I think a questionnaire is certainly more beneficial than no questionnaire.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Friel, any response?
Oh, only that the state objects to it as a whole, Your Honor. Most of the questions that the state would not object to are already on our questionnaire. I mean, our questionnaire is short that we send out, that's already been sent out, but I believe it covers a lot of these things, hobbies, television, whether you're married, those kind of things that we ask in every single criminal case that Your Honor presides or I prosecute. And I just think at this late hour, even on July 3rd, there's no time. There's no time for Your Honor or the state, who has to put together a homicide case, to go through these and parse them out. And for the most part, we would object to almost every single question.
All right. Thank you both very much. I have had a chance to review the defendant's proposed jury questionnaires to be sent out. And no, I'm not going to, we're not going to send them out. There's absolutely no time. Today is Tuesday, July 16th. The jurors are scheduled to be here on Monday, July 22nd at 8:30 a.m. to begin jury selection. That's less than a week to finalize the jury questionnaires, get them sent out to the 500 people that receive summonses. And obviously the reason, pulling back the curtain, and I'm sure everybody can figure this out, the reason we send out 500 summonses is because not everybody can make it, right? Some people have trips. Some people receive a summons, and they one of the statutorily based reasons to be excused fits them. And we're attempting to get a yield of attorney jurors to show up, from which we can then pick our trials for that day. And I've asked for 70. There is another trial going on I know of, and I think they're going to have 40 or 50 as their panel. So there's 120. There may be some civil cases and other misdemeanor cases, so I believe I asked for 500 summonses to be sent. But you never know who's going to show up or who's going to be excused. And then I have no idea of those 500 what 70 are going to be on our panel. So in order to send out this questionnaire, it would have to go to all 500. And when I would prefer to do that, and when I think is appropriate to do that, is when the summonses went out. And they went out probably 5 or 6 weeks ago. Obviously, they have to be sent out well in advance. So I'm not fundamentally opposed to jury questionnaires. I would not be opposed to a jury questionnaire in this case. But in order to do it and do it right and have meaningful responses, this issue needed to have been raised months ago. So I'm going to deny the jury questionnaires. The matters addressed will just have to be addressed during jury selection, which I will cover. I know the state is trying. Have you had a trial in front of me yet? Have you tried a case in front of me yet?
I have not.
All right. Then when I go through my pretrial colloquy, you'll be able to hear quite a few of the ways I do things. All right. Before I do my pretrial colloquy, though, we also had the request for paralegal to remain at council table. Yes, sir.
While this is probably the most significant motion, at least for the defense, that's on the court's docket for this morning, I don't know that it'll take the most amount of time. Simply put, as I've articulated in the motion, along with my affidavit, and I cannot draw a more poignant justification for it than what occurred in chambers or ex parte this morning, where the court made an inquiry of me that I did not know and told the court, I don't know, but if Mr. O'Keefe was here, he would know. The court was kind enough to give me an opportunity to ask Mr. O'Keefe when I came out, and of course he gave me the answer immediately, which I advised the court of. That is precisely an example of why I have filed the motion that I have. The irony of this motion is that for some reason that the court has yet to disclose, the court has refused to make a decision on this request. From all my experience, I can only tell Your Honor that I would have thought this would have been a pro forma request of the court that would have been granted straight away. That's obviously not the case. I cannot speculate as to what possible reason the court would have to deny me the assistance in the presentation of a defense on a homicide case where a young woman with a six-year-old child is facing a 25-year sentence to life. There are two assistant state attorneys that are conducting the state's case. I am by myself if I do not have any assistance. As the court probably knows from its own experience, at least in my experience, respectfully, Your Honor, given some 400 felony trials, homicide cases are usually two counsel cases at a minimum. In a case like this, because of not only all the discovery, but all the electronic medium that's involved, the number of witnesses, the complexity of all the issues, the motions that have been filed, I don't think the court will deny that we've motioned the court with incorporated memoranda of law since day one on every significant issue. I cannot do this by myself. I don't know that I need to be singled out as incapable of that at 74. I think that that would be an impediment to just about any individual who tries a homicide case by themselves. But I am unaware of any rule or law that would preclude Jack O'Keefe sitting at counsel table to be able to assist me. The court had earlier mentioned that it would be satisfied having Jack O'Keefe sit at the bench. And for the record, the court's configuration is set up such that behind the defense table where counsel and the accused sit is a bench where the court has indicated Mr. O'Keefe would be able to sit. That bench is behind counsel table, and I'm in a position where I would not only have to turn my back on the proceedings for everything I needed to ask Mr. O'Keefe, such as what transpired this morning, and lose my attention to what's taking place, but my client, Ms. Benefield, has gone through this undertaking with Mr. O'Keefe at her side since the beginning. Mr. O'Keefe was involved in the case before I filed my notice of appearance. I believe I've been on the case going on 3 years. I was not the original attorney, it was the public defender. When I came into the case, I very quickly realized just how knowledgeable Mr. O'Keefe was. But in addition to his knowledge, he's been blessed with an eidetic memory. I am not. I cannot recall specific minutiae. Mr. O'Keefe can. He has been highly instrumental in organizing the file, All the witness files, the way that I proceed to conduct the trial, Judge White, is for every witness there is a file. Every statement related to that witness is in the file. Every memoranda that applies to that witness is in the file, as is any deposition and transcript of court testimony and any impeaching evidence. The list of witnesses in this case, both sides combined, potential witnesses, is probably more than 30. Mr. O'Keefe has helped me assemble all of those files. He has knowledge of all of those files. He is skilled at using his computer to be able to present on the overhead various documents that I would want the jurors to see. Unfortunately, life is such that the courtroom, to a certain extent, remains theater. And just like public speaking, a broken presentation, a disjointed presentation, has an impact on the audience's perception of the quality of what's being advanced. I am not nearly as skilled as he. I will not be able to provide the exhibits in the same amount of time that Mr. O'Keefe can, so that the jurors can view them and so that there's minimal interruption to my cross-examination. As I've stated earlier, a cross-examination that's interrupted, just like an argument, begins to lose its gravitas. I cannot conduct this trial effectively without help. If the court, for whatever reason the court has, I'm hoping that we're going to hear and we're going to learn what it is, will not allow Mr. O'Keefe to sit with me, then I'm going to ask Your Honor to appoint counsel. We can go through the indigency status of Ms. Benefield. I can assure the court that she is in fact indigent. And when counsel is up to speed and I have the help that I need, then we can try this case. But otherwise, under these conditions, without the assistance of Mr. O'Keefe, the court is prohibiting me from not only being effective, but is rendering Ms. Benefield's right to a fair trial. The court's putting her in a position where she's going to be denied the trial that she's entitled to. That is the basis of my motion. I hope the court will allow me to have the assistance that I need. If Your Honor has any questions.
Before I go to the state, under what rule, statute, or case is this request based?
I gave the court the case law and the authority that I relied upon. I attached it to my motion. I cited it in the motion specifically, Your Honor. It was the case of Florida Greyhound Lines, Inc. versus Jones at 60 Southern 2nd, 396, page 397. This case goes back to 1952, and the defense raised as an objection the trial court's allowing an investigator to sit and aid the defense at counsel table. This is what the Florida Supreme Court had to say when they made quick work of it. The appellant also feels that an injustice was done when the judge permitted an investigator employed by the appellee's attorneys to sit at counsel table. We agree with the trial judge that this was a discretionary matter, and we have been shown nothing to indicate an abuse of that discretion or any advantage to appellees from having immediately available such advice,
and information as the investigator was prepared to offer. Now, you know, Your Honor, with all due respect to the trial court's discretion, this will be, make no mistake, an abuse of that discretion if Your Honor denies me the assistance that I need to ensure that my client receives a fair trial. That's my authority for it, and it comes within the trial court's discretion, and I see absolutely no reason to deny it.
And you demand me to put on the record my reasons why?
And I demand?
For me to put the reasons why on the record.
Well, I think the court should state its reasons.
As a matter of discretion?
Well, this case may end up going up, Your Honor, and I want the appellate court to understand if what not only that I was denied assistance, I want the appellate court to understand why the trial court denied it. And I can't imagine any reason why the court would be reluctant to give us an explanation. I think we're entitled to a fair opportunity and a level playing field.
All right, anything else?
That's all.
All right, Ms. Friel?
Thank you, Judge.
As we've heard clearly, this is a discretionary matter.
Yes.
I don't have to have a reason.
I understand.
It's purely discretion. But if you'd like to be heard, you certainly can.
I would, if Your Honor would allow. I just, for the record, would like to tell Your Honor that according to Galvano, Grimes, all the names listed on their website, there are 11 other barred attorneys at that firm besides Mr. Taylor, five of which list trial practice as one of their specialties. Another one of which also lists criminal law as one of his specialties. Mr. Taylor is attempting to hold the court hostage and force Your Honor to allow Mr. O'Keefe to sit at the table by saying that you are preventing him from getting help. You are not preventing him. The court would not be preventing him. You're preventing what the state feels is the unlicensed practice of law. Mr. Taylor says that he needs Mr. O'Keefe to respond to questions an issue my client has without having to divert my attention to the testimony. They're asking the court to be complicit in the unlicensed practice of law. That is Mr. O'Keefe practicing law. He is not in a position to answer questions about what is happening in this trial, legal issues. There's rules. The rules of unlicensed practice of law, 4.5, 4-5.3, say, if an activity requires the independent judgment and participation of a lawyer, it cannot be properly delegated to a non-lawyer employee. And that's what he's asking to do. The trial exhibits and folders that have all these things in them should all be done before trial begins. Mr. O'Keefe can do all those things from the audience where he belongs. The state has two attorneys on this case. We are attorneys. We took the bar and have worked at this job for a very long time. It is egregious for the defense counsel to ask Your Honor, to try to hold Your Honor hostage and force Your Honor to let him have a non-barred paralegal practice law in this court during a homicide trial. Especially having said to Your Honor that he's done 400 felony trials. Mr. Taylor accepted this trial, this job, this client 4 years ago. He know his skills, and he's had 4 years to learn how to present evidence. I can't imagine that he cannot work or learn how to work a DVD player. And if he can't, then somebody who's barred could help him. Or even if Mr. O'Keefe has to walk up and turn a DVD player on, he then goes and sits in the back. So the state is objecting on many issues, but the main issue is that I think they're asking you to be complicit in the practice of law based on the affidavit that reads wildly like he's asking for that, and even the motion that says he's involved in the legal issues in this case, and the state is just asking that you deny the request to have Mr. O'Keefe sit at the table. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Taylor, rebuttal.
Briefly, yes. I'm the only attorney affiliated with Grimes Galvano that practices criminal law. Secondly,
At no time did I represent, in fact, quite the contrary, I went out of my way to point out that Mr. O'Keefe will not participate in the trial itself. He does not need to be identified. He will address no one other than Ms. Benefield, and he comes underneath the attorney-client privilege. And thirdly, Your Honor, in response to the state's allegation that it would be practicing law without a license, perhaps I missed the case I cited to the court, but that was an investigator, not a lawyer, and it was allowed back in 1952. So here we are in 2024.
Ah, there it is. All right, let me read the case that you cited, which is Florida Greyhound Lines versus Jones, 60 Southern 2nd, 396. Supreme Court of Florida, 1952. The entire extent of the reference to an investigator employed by the appellee's attorneys to sit at counsel table, that's it. The entire thing is that little bit that was read and is reflected in the quote in the defendant's motion. It's two sentences, that's it. I'm not aware of any other authority supporting or preventing the request. I am well aware of the provisions when you start talking about the rule of sequestration, where certain witnesses, even if they are subject to being sequestered, can remain in the courtroom when they are there to assist the attorneys with, say, expert witnesses or their attendance is necessary. Marcy's Law has given us some examples of perhaps exceptions to the rule of sequestration. But that's all I'm aware of. The Sixth Amendment right to counsel of choice is scrupulously honored. And Ms. Benefield, by hiring Mr. Taylor, has expressed and exercised her Sixth Amendment right for her attorney of choice. I previously, at another hearing, and I didn't write down the date, that I wanted to have an on-the-record colloquy with Ms. Benefield to confirm that she had read the request for paralegal to remain at counsel table and the affidavit of Mr. Taylor. She confirmed. I provided her copies in court. She confirmed that she had read them. I asked regarding some of the specific allegations in both the motion or the request and in the affidavit. And Ms. Benefield confirmed that she wanted Mr. Taylor to remain as her attorney, regardless of whether or not I granted this request. I also referenced the Florida Rules of Professional Conduct, specifically Rule 4-1.16A2.
and had just expressed that I am confident Mr. Taylor is familiar with the rules of professional conduct, and if he is not physically or mentally prepared to try this case, that he has certain obligations under those rules of professional conduct in moving forward. I don't think I'm required to give an answer as to why or how I run my courtroom. I can say this: I have offered what I think to be a very reasonable resolution that Mr. O'Keefe can sit directly behind defense counsel table, which has a pew, which is a wooden pew. It's approximately, I'd say, 15 feet long, sits directly behind counsel table. And if someone is sitting comfortably at defense counsel table, you can swivel in your chair and touch the bench that's behind that table. The state would have me have Mr. O'Keefe in the audience, which would essentially just put him about 2 feet further back in a bench there. And certainly I'll note that that's where my paralegal would sit when I tried cases. But I'm attempting to come up with a reasonable resolution. So at this point, Mr. O'Keefe may not sit at counsel table. If you want, he can sit directly behind at that bench. If you prefer he not sit there, that's fine too, and he can sit in the audience. I think I don't think I need to go through the rest of my notes. It's a discretionary matter, and that is my decision. All right, now we need to finish up with my trial colloquy. Put down to do a simple written order.
Thank you.
More continuing coverage is on the way.
The Black Swan murder trial of Ashley Benefield from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Press subscribe now.